laboratory, leading the raptors away from Gennaro and the kids. He could see another door nearer the front, which was marked to laboratory, whatever that meant. He had an idea, and he hoped he was right. The door had a blue biohazard sign. The raptors were coming closer. Grant turned and slammed into the door and moved beyond it into a deep, warm silence. He turned. Yes! He was where he wanted to be, in the hatchery, beneath infrared lights, long tables with rows of eggs, and a low, clinging mist. The rockers on the tables clicked and whirred in a steady motion. The mist poured over the sides of the tables and drifted to the floor, where it disappeared, evaporated. Grant ran directly to the rear of the hatchery, into a glass-walled laboratory with ultraviolet light. His clothing glowed blue. He looked around at the glass reagents, beakers full of pipettes, glass dishes, all delicate laboratory equipment. The raptors entered the room, cautiously at first, sniffing the humid air, looking at the long, rocking tables of eggs. The lead animal wiped its bloody jaws with the back of its forearm. Silently, the raptors passed between the long tables. The animals moved through the room in a coordinated way, ducking from time to time to peer beneath the tables. They were looking for him. Grant crouched and moved to the back of the laboratory, looked up, and saw the metal hood marked with a skull and crossbones. A sign said, "Caution, biogenic toxins, A4 precautions required." Grant remembered that Regis had said they were powerful poisons. Only a few molecules would kill instantaneously. The hood lay flush against the surface of the lab table. Grant could not slip his hand under it. He tried to open it, but there was no door, no handle, no way that he could see. Grant rose slowly and glanced back at the main room. The raptors were still moving among the tables. He turned to the hood. He saw an odd metal fixture sunk into the surface of the table. It looked like an outdoor electrical outlet with a round cover. He flipped up the cover, saw a button, pressed it. With a soft hiss, the hood slid upward to the ceiling. He saw glass shelves above him, and rows of bottles marked with a skull and crossbones. He peered at the labels, CCK-55, Tetra-alpha-secretin, Thymol-11X-1612. The fluids glowed pale green in the ultraviolet light. Nearby he saw a glass dish with syringes in it. The syringes were small, each containing a tiny amount of green glowing fluid. Crouched in the blue darkness, Grant reached for the dish of syringes. The needles on the syringes were capped in plastic. He removed one cap, pulling it off with his teeth. He looked at the thin needle. He moved forward, toward the raptors. He had devoted his whole life to studying dinosaurs. Now he would see how much he really knew. Velociraptors were small, carnivorous dinosaurs, like oviraptors and dromaeosaurs, animals that were long thought to steal eggs. Just as certain modern birds ate the eggs of other birds, Grant had always assumed that velociraptors would eat dinosaur eggs if they could. He crept forward to the nearest egg table in the hatchery. Slowly he reached up into the mist and took a large egg from the rocking table. The egg was almost the size of a football, cream-colored with faint pink speckling. He held the egg carefully while he stuck the needle through the shell and injected the contents of the syringe. The egg glowed faint blue. Grant bent down again. Beneath the table, he saw the legs of the raptors and the mist pouring down from the tabletops. He rolled the glowing egg along the floor toward the raptors. The raptors looked up, hearing the faint rumble as the egg rolled, and jerked their heads around. Then they resumed their slow, stalking search. The egg stopped several yards from the nearest raptor. Damn! Grant did it all again, quietly reaching up for an egg, bringing it down, injecting it, and rolling it toward the raptors. This time the egg came to rest by the foot of one velociraptor. It rocked gently, clicking against the big toe claw. The raptor looked down in surprise at this new gift. It bent over and sniffed the glowing egg. It rolled the egg with its snout along the floor for a moment, and ignored it. The velociraptor stood upright again and slowly moved on, continuing to search. It wasn't working. Grant reached for a third egg and injected it with a fresh syringe. He held the glowing egg in his hands and rolled it again. But he rolled this one fast, like a bowling ball. The egg rattled across the floor loudly. One of the animals heard the sound, ducked down, saw it coming, and instinctively chased the moving object, gliding swiftly among the tables to intercept the egg as it rolled. The big jaws snapped down and bit into it, crushing the shell. The raptor stood, pale albumen dripping from its jaws. It licked its lips noisily and snorted. It bit again and lapped the egg from the floor. But it didn't seem to be in the least distressed. It bent over to eat again from the broken egg. Grant looked down to see what would happen. From across the room, the raptor saw him. It was looking right at him. The velociraptor snarled menacingly. It moved toward Grant, crossing the room in long, incredibly swift strides. Grant was shocked to see it happening and froze in panic, when suddenly the animal made a gasping, gurgling sound, and the big body pitched forward onto the ground. The heavy tail thumped the floor in spasms. The raptor continued to make choking sounds, punctuated by intermittent loud shrieks. Foam bubbled from its mouth. The head flopped back and forth. The tail slammed and thumped. That's one, Grant thought. But it wasn't dying very fast. It seemed to take forever to die. Grant reached up for another egg and saw that the other raptors in the room were frozen in mid-action. They listened to the sound of the dying animal. One cocked its head, then another, and another. The first animal moved to look at the fallen raptor. The dying raptor was now twitching, the whole body shaking on the floor. It made pitiful moans. So much foam bubbled from its mouth that Grant could hardly see the head anymore. It flopped on the floor and moaned again. The second raptor bent over the fallen animal, examining it. It appeared to be puzzled by these death throes. Cautiously, it looked at the foaming head, then moved down to the twitching neck, the heaving ribs, the legs, and it took a bite from the hind leg. The dying animal snarled and suddenly lifted its head and twisted, sinking its teeth into the neck of its attacker. That's two, Grant thought. But the standing animal wrenched free. Blood flowed from its neck. It struck out with its hind claws, and with a single swift movement, ripped open the belly of the fallen animal. Coils of intestine fell out like fat snakes. The screams of the dying raptor filled the room. The attacker turned away as if fighting was suddenly too much trouble. It crossed the room, ducked down, and came up with a glowing egg. Grant watched as the raptor bit into it, the glowing material dripping down its chin. That makes two. The second raptor was stricken almost instantly, coughing and pitching forward. As it fell, it knocked over a table. Dozens of eggs rolled everywhere across the floor. Grant looked at them in dismay. There was still a third raptor left. Grant had one more syringe. With so many eggs rolling on the floor, he would have to do something else. He was trying to decide what to do when the last animal snorted irritably. Grant looked up. The raptor had spotted him. The final raptor did not move for a long time. It just stared. And then it slowly, quietly came forward, stalking him, bobbing up and down, looking first beneath the tables, then above them. It moved deliberately, cautiously, with none of the swiftness that it had displayed in a pack. A solitary animal now, it was careful. It never took its eyes off Grant. Grant looked around quickly. There was nowhere for him to hide. Nothing for him to do. Grant's gaze was fixed on the raptor, moving slowly, laterally. Grant moved too. He tried to keep as many tables as he could between himself and the advancing animal. Slowly, slowly, he moved to the left. The raptor advanced in the dark red gloom of the hatchery. Its breath came in soft hisses through flared nostrils. Grant felt eggs breaking beneath his feet, the yolk sticking to the soles of his shoes. He crouched down, felt the bulge of the radio in his pocket. The radio! He pulled it from his pocket and turned it on. Hello, this is Grant.
Alan?
Ellie's voice.
Alan?
Listen, he said softly, just talk.
Alan, is that you?
Talk, he said again. And he pushed the radio across the floor, away from him, toward the advancing raptor. He crouched behind a table leg and waited.
Alan? Speak to me, please.
Then a crackle and silence. The radio remained silent. The raptor advanced, soft, hissing breath. The radio was still silent. What was the matter with her? Didn't she understand? In the darkness, the raptor came closer.
Alan?
The tinny voice from the radio made the big animal pause. It sniffed the air, as if sensing someone else in the room.
Alan, it's me. I don't know if you can hear me.
The raptor now turned away from Grant and moved toward the radio.
Alan, please!
Why hadn't he pushed the radio farther away? The raptor was going toward it, but it was close. The big foot came down very near him. Grant could see the pebbled skin, the soft green glow, the streaks of dried blood on the curved claw. He could smell the strong reptile odor.
Alan, listen to me! Alan!
The raptor bent over, poked at the radio on the floor tentatively. Its body was turned away from Grant. The big tail was right above Grant's head. Grant reached up and jabbed the syringe deep into the flesh of the tail and injected the poison. The velociraptor snarled and jumped. With frightening speed, it swung back toward Grant, jaws wide. It snapped, its jaws closing on the table leg, and jerked its head up. The table was knocked away, and Grant fell back, now completely exposed. The raptor loomed over him, rising up, its head banging into the infrared lights above, making them swing crazily.
Alan?
The raptor reared back and lifted its clawed foot to kick. Grant rolled, and the foot slammed down, just missing him. He felt a searing, sharp pain along his shoulder blades, the sudden warm flow of blood over his shirt. He rolled across the floor, crushing eggs, smearing his hands, his face. The raptor kicked again, smashing down on the radio, spattering sparks. It snarled in rage and kicked a third time, and Grant came to the wall, nowhere else to go, and the animal raised its foot a final time and toppled backward. The animal was wheezing. Foam came from its mouth. Gennaro and the kids came into the room. Grant signaled them to stay back. The girl looked at the dying animal and said softly,
"Wow."
Gennaro helped Grant to his feet. They all turned and ran for the control room. Control. Tim was astonished to find the screen in the control room was now flashing on and off. Lex said,
"What happened?"
Some of the labels were flashing. Security main, monitor main, command main, electrical main, master main, zoological main, set grids DNL, access TNL, critical lock, status main, control pass-through, telecom RSD, safety stroke health. Tim saw Dr. Grant staring at the screen and gingerly moving his hand toward the keyboard. "I don't know about computers," Grant said, shaking his head. But Tim was already sliding into the seat. He touched the screen rapidly. On the video monitors, he could see the boat moving closer to Punta Arenas. It was now only about 200 yards from the dock. On the other monitor, he saw the lodge with the raptors hanging down from the ceiling. On the radio, he heard their snarls.
"Do something, Timmy," Lex said.
He pushed set grids DNL, even though it was flashing. The screen answered, "Warning, command execution aborted, auxiliary power low."
"What does that mean?" Tim said.
Gennaro snapped his fingers. "That happened before. It means auxiliary power is low. You have to turn on main power."
"I do?"
He pushed electrical main. Another screen came up, headed electrical main control modules, with rows of numbered labels underneath. Tim groaned. "What are you doing now?" Grant said. The whole screen was starting to flash. Tim pushed main. Nothing happened. The screen continued to flash. Tim pushed main grid P. He felt sick to his stomach with fear. "Main power grid not active, stroke auxiliary power only." The screen was still flashing. He pushed main set 1. "Main power activated." All the lights in the room came on. All the monitor screens stopped flashing.
"Hey! All right!"
Tim pressed reset grids. Nothing happened for a moment. He glanced at the video monitors, then back at the main screen. "Which grid do you want to reset? Park? Maint? Security? Lodge? Other?" Grant said something that Tim didn't hear. He only heard the tension in his voice. He was looking at Tim, worried. Tim felt his heart thumping in his chest. Lex was yelling at him. He didn't want to look at the video monitor anymore. He could hear the sound of the bars bending in the lodge and the raptors snarling. He heard Malcolm say,
"Dear God."
He pushed lodge. "Specify grid number to reset." For a frozen, interminable moment, he couldn't remember the number. But then he remembered F4, and he pressed that. Activating Lodge Grid F4 now. On the video monitor, he saw an explosion of sparks sputtering down from the ceiling of the hotel room. The monitor flared white. Lex shouted, "What did you do?" But almost immediately the image came back, and they could see that the raptors were caught between the bars, writhing and screaming in a hot cascade of sparks, while Muldoon and the others cheered, their voices tinny over the radio. "That's it," Grant said, slapping Timmy on the back. "That's it! You did it!" They were all standing and jumping up and down when Lex said, "What about the ship?"
"The what?"
"The ship," she said, and pointed to the screen. On the monitor, the buildings beyond the bow of the ship were much larger and moving to the right as the ship turned left and prepared to dock. He saw crewmen heading out to the bow, preparing to tie up. Tim scrambled back to his seat and stared at the startup screen. He studied the screen. Telecom VBB and Telecom RSD both looked like they might have something to do with telephones. He pressed Telecom RSD. "You have 23 waiting calls and or messages. Do you wish to receive them now?" He pushed no.
"Maybe the ship was one of the waiting calls," Lex said. "Maybe that way you could get the phone number."
He ignored. Ian Malcolm. Destroying the World. They moved Malcolm to another room in the lodge, to a clean bed. Hammond seemed to revive and began bustling around, straightening up.
"Well," he said, "at least disaster is averted."
"What disaster is that?" Malcolm said, sighing.
"Well," Hammond said, "they didn't get free and overrun the world."
Malcolm sat up on one elbow.
"You were worried about that?"
"Surely that's what was at stake," Hammond said. "These animals, lacking predators, might get out and destroy the planet."
"You egomaniacal idiot," Malcolm said in a fury. "Do you have any idea what you are talking about? You think you can destroy the planet? My, what intoxicating power you must have."
Malcolm sank back on the bed.
"You can't destroy this planet. You can't even come close."
"Most people believe," Hammond said stiffly, "that the planet is in jeopardy."
"Well, it's not," Malcolm said.
"All the experts agree that our planet is in trouble."
Malcolm sighed.
"Let me tell you about our planet," he said. "Our planet is 4.5 billion years old. There has been life on this planet for nearly that long. 3.8 billion years. The first bacteria, and later the first multicellular animals, then the first complex creatures in the sea, on the land. Then the great sweeping ages of animals, the amphibians, the dinosaurs, the mammals, each lasting millions upon millions of years. Great dynasties of creatures arising, flourishing, dying away. All this happening against a background of continuous and violent upheaval. Mountain ranges thrust up and eroded away, cometary impacts, volcanic eruptions, oceans rising and falling, whole continents moving. Endless, constant, and violent change. Even today, the greatest geographical feature on the planet comes from two great continents colliding, buckling, to make the Himalayan mountain range over millions of years. The planet has survived everything in its time. It will certainly survive us."
Hammond frowned.
"Just because it lasted a long time," he said, "doesn't mean it is permanent. If there was a radiation accident..."
"Suppose there was," Malcolm said. "Let's say we had a bad one, and all the plants and animals died, and the earth was clicking hot for 100,000 years. Life would survive somewhere, under the soil, or perhaps frozen in Arctic ice. And after all those years, when the planet was no longer inhospitable, life would again spread over the planet. The evolutionary process would begin again. It might take a few billion years for life to regain its present variety. And, of course, it would be very different from what it is now. But the Earth would survive our folly. Life would survive our folly. Only we," Malcolm said, "think it wouldn't."
Hammond said, "Well, if the ozone layer gets thinner, There will be more ultraviolet radiation reaching the surface. So what? Well, it'll cause skin cancer.
Malcolm shook his head.
Ultraviolet radiation is good for life. It's powerful energy. It promotes mutation, change. Many forms of life will thrive with more UV radiation.
And many others will die out, Hammond said.
Malcolm sighed.
You think this is the first time such a thing has happened? Don't you know about oxygen?
I know what's necessary for life.
It is now, Malcolm said. But oxygen is actually a metabolic poison. It's a corrosive gas like fluorine, which is used to etch glass. And when oxygen was first produced as a waste product by certain plant cells, say around 3 billion years ago, it created a crisis for all other life on our planet. Those plant cells were polluting the environment with a deadly poison. They were exhaling a lethal gas and building up its concentration. A planet like Venus has less than 1% oxygen. On Earth, the concentration of oxygen was going up rapidly, 5, 10, eventually 21%. Earth had an atmosphere of pure poison, incompatible with life.
Hammond looked irritated.
So what is your point? That modern pollutants will be incorporated too?
No, Malcolm said. My point is that life on Earth can take care of itself. In the thinking of a human being, 100 years is a long time. 100 years ago, we didn't have cars and airplanes and computers and vaccines. It was a whole different world. But to the Earth, 100 years is nothing. 1,000,000 years is nothing. This planet lives and breathes on a much vaster scale. We can't imagine its slow and powerful rhythms, and we haven't got the humility to try. We have been residents here for the blink of an eye. If we are gone tomorrow, the Earth will not miss us.
And we very well might be gone, Hammond said, huffing.
Yes, Malcolm said, we might.
So what are you saying, we shouldn't care about the environment?
No, of course not.
Then what?
Malcolm coughed and stared into the distance.
Let's be clear. The planet is not in jeopardy. We are in jeopardy. We haven't got the power to destroy the planet or to save it. But we might have the power to save ourselves.
Under control. 4 hours had passed. It was afternoon, the sun was falling. The air conditioning was back on in the control room, and the computer was functioning properly. As near as they could determine, out of 24 people on the island, 8 were dead, and 6 more were missing. The visitor center and the safari lodge were both secure, and the northern perimeter seemed to be clear of dinosaurs. They had called authorities in San Jose for help. The Costa Rican National Guard was on its way, as well as an air ambulance to carry Malcolm to a hospital. But over the telephone, the Costa Rican guard had been distinctly cautious. Undoubtedly, calls would go back and forth between San Jose and Washington before help was finally sent to the island. And now it was growing late in the day. If the helicopters did not arrive soon, they would have to wait until morning. In the meantime, there was nothing to do but wait. The ship was returning. The crew had discovered 3 young raptors scampering about in one of the aft holds and had killed the animals. On Isla Nublar, the immediate danger appeared to have passed. Everyone was in either the visitor center or the lodge. Tim had gotten quite good with a computer, and he flashed up a new screen. Total animals, 292. Tyrannosaurs expected, 2. Found, 1. Version 4.1. Myosaurs expected, 22. Found, 20. Version unknown. Stegosaurs expected, 4. Found, 1. Version 3.9. Triceratops expected, 8. Found, 6. Version 3.1. Procompsognathids expected, 65. Found, 64. Version unknown. Othnelia expected, 23. Found, 15. Version 3.1. Velociraptors expected, 37. Found, 27. Version unknown. Apatosaurs expected, 17. Found, 12. Version 3.1. Hadrosaurs expected, 11. Found, 5. Version 3.1. Dilophosaurs expected 7, found 4, version 4.3. Pterosaurs expected 6, found 5, version 4.3. Hypsilophodontids expected 34, found 14, version unknown. Euplocephalids expected 16, found 9, version 4.0. Styracosaurs expected 18, found 7, version 3.9. Microceratops expected 22, found 13, version 4.1. Total expected 292, total found 203.
What the hell is it doing now? Gennaro said. Now it says there are fewer animals.
Grant nodded. Probably.
Ellie said, Jurassic Park is finally coming under control.
Meaning what?
Equilibrium.
Grant pointed to the monitors. On one of them, the hypsilophodonts leapt into the air as a pack of velociraptors entered the field from the west.
The fences have been down for hours, Grant said. The animals are mingling with each other, populations reaching equilibrium, a true Jurassic equilibrium.
I don't think it was supposed to happen, Gennaro said. The animals were never supposed to mix.
Well, they are.
On another monitor, Grant saw a pack of raptors racing at full speed across an open field toward a 4-ton hadrosaur. The hadrosaur turned to flee, and one of the raptors jumped onto its back, biting into the long neck, while the others raced forward, circled around it, nipped at its legs, leapt up to slash at the belly with their powerful claws. Within minutes, 6 raptors had brought down the larger animal. Grant stared silently. Ellie said, Is it the way you imagined?
I don't know what I imagined, he said.
He watched the monitor.
No, not exactly.
Muldoon said quietly,
You know, it appears all the adult raptors are out right now.
Grant didn't pay much attention at first. He just watched the monitors, the interaction of the great animals. In the south, the stegosaur was swinging its spiked tail, warily circling the baby tyrannosaur, which watched it, bemused, and occasionally lunged forward to nip ineffectually at the spikes. In the western quadrant, the adult triceratopsians were fighting among themselves, charging and locking horns. One animal already lay wounded and dying.
Muldoon said, We've got about an hour of good daylight left, Dr. Grant, if you want to try and find that nest.
Right, Grant said, I do.
I was thinking, Muldoon said, that when the Costa Ricans come, they will probably imagine this island to be a military problem, something to destroy as soon as possible.
Damn right, Gennaro said.
They'll bomb it from the air, Muldoon said. Perhaps napalm, perhaps nerve gas as well, but from the air.
I hope they do, Gennaro said. This island is too dangerous. Every animal in this island must be destroyed, and the sooner the better.
Grant said, That's not satisfactory. He got to his feet.
Let's get started.
I don't think you understand, Alan, Gennaro said. It's my opinion that this island is too dangerous. It must be destroyed. Every animal on this island must be destroyed.
And that's what the Costa Rican guard will do.
I think we should leave it in their capable hands. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Perfectly, Grant said again.
Then what's your problem? Gennaro said. It's a military operation. Let them do it.
Grant's back ached, for the raptor had clawed him.
No, he said. We have to take care of it.
Leave it to the experts, Gennaro said.
Grant remembered how he had found Gennaro just 6 hours earlier, huddled and terrified in the cab of a truck in the maintenance building. And suddenly he lost his temper and slammed the lawyer up against the concrete wall.
Listen, you little bastard! You have a responsibility to this situation, and you're going to start living up to it.
I am, Gennaro said, coughing.
No, you're not. You've shirked your responsibility all along from the very beginning.
The hell!
You sold investors on an undertaking you didn't fully understand. You were part owner of a business you failed to supervise. You did not check the activities of a man whom you knew from experience to be a liar, and you permitted that man to screw around with the most dangerous technology in human history. I'd say you shirked your responsibility.
Gennaro coughed again.
Well, now I'm taking responsibility.
No, Grant said, you're still shirking it. And you can't do that anymore.
He released Gennaro, who bent over, gasping for breath. Grant turned to Muldoon.
What have we got for weapons?
Muldoon said, we've got some control nets and shock prods.
How good are these shock prods? Grant said.
They're like bang sticks for sharks. They have an explosive capacitor tip. Delivers a shock on contact. High voltage, low amps. Not fatal, but it's definitely incapacitating.
That's not going to do it, Grant said. Not in the nest. What nest? Gennaro said, coughing.
The raptor nest, Ellie said. The raptor nest?
Grant was saying, have you got any radio collars?
I'm sure we do, Muldoon said.
Get one. And is there anything else that can be used for defense?
Muldoon shook his head.
Well, get whatever you can.
Muldoon went away. Grant turned to Gennaro. Your island is a mess, Mr. Gennaro. Your experiment is a mess. It has to be cleaned up. But you can't do that until you know the extent of the mess, and that means finding the nests on the island, especially the raptor nests. They'll be hidden. We have to find them, and inspect them, and count the eggs. We have to account for every animal born on this island. Then we can burn it down. But first, we have a little work to do.
Ellie was looking at the wall map, which now showed the animal ranges. Tim was working the keyboard. She pointed to the map.
The raptors are localized in the southern area, down where the volcanic steam fields are. Maybe they like the warmth.
Is there any place to hide down there?
Turns out there is, she said. There's massive concrete waterworks to control flooding in the southern flatlands. Big underground area, water and shade.
Grant nodded. Then that's where they'll be.
Ellie said, I think there's an entrance from the beach, too.
She turned to the consoles and said, Tim, show us the cutaways on the waterworks.
Tim wasn't listening.
Tim?
He was hunched over the keyboard.
Just a minute, he said. I found something.
What is it?
It's an unmarked storage room. I don't know what's there.
Then it might have weapons, Grant said.
They were all behind the maintenance building, unlocking a steel storm door, lifting it up into the sunlight to reveal concrete steps going down into the earth.
Damn Arnold, Muldoon said as he hobbled down the steps. He must have known this was here all along.
Maybe not, Grant said. He didn't try to go here.
Well then, Hammond knew. Somebody knew.
Where is Hammond now?
Still in the lodge.
They reached the bottom of the stairs and came upon rows of gas masks hanging on the wall in plastic containers. They shone their flashlights deeper into the room and saw several heavy glass cubes, 2 feet high, with steel caps. Grant could see small, dark spheres inside the cubes. It was like being in a room full of giant pepper mills, he thought.
Muldoon opened the cap of one, reached in, and withdrew a sphere. He turned it in the light, frowning.
I'll be damned.
What is it? Grant said.
Moro 12, Muldoon said. It's an inhalation nerve gas. These are grenades. Lots and lots of grenades.
Let's get started, Grant said grimly.
It likes me,
Lex said, smiling. They were standing in the garage of the visitor center by the little raptor that Grant had captured in the tunnel. She was petting the raptor through the cage bars. The animal rubbed up against her hand.
I'd be careful there, Muldoon said. They can give a nasty bite.
He likes me, Lex said. His name is Clarence.
Clarence?
Yes, Lex said.
Muldoon was holding the leather collar with a small metal box attached to it. Grant heard the high-pitched beeping in the headset.
Is it a problem, putting the collar on the animal?
Lex was still petting the raptor, reaching through the cage.
I bet he'll let me put it on him, she said.
I wouldn't try, Muldoon said. They're unpredictable.
I bet he'll let me, she said.
So Muldoon gave Lex the collar, and she held it out so the raptor could smell it. Then she slowly slipped it around the animal's neck. The raptor turned brighter green when Lex buckled it and closed the Velcro cover over the buckle. Then the animal relaxed and turned paler again.
I'll be damned, Muldoon said.
It's a chameleon, Lex said.
The other raptors couldn't do that, Muldoon said, frowning. This wild animal must be different. By the way, he said, turning to Grant, if they're all born females, how do they breed? You never explained that bit about the frog DNA.
It's not frog DNA, Grant said. It's amphibian DNA. but the phenomenon happens to be particularly well documented in frogs, especially West African frogs, if I remember.
What phenomenon is that?
Gender transition, Grant said. Actually, it's just plain changing sex. Grant explained that a number of plants and animals were known to have the ability to change their sex during life. Orchids, some fish and shrimp, and now frogs. Frogs that had been observed to lay eggs were able to change over a period of months into complete males. They first adopted the fighting stance of males. They developed the mating whistle of males. They stimulated the hormones and grew the gonads of males. And eventually they successfully mated with females.
You're kidding, Gennaro said.
And what makes it happen?
Apparently the change is stimulated by an environment in which all the animals are of the same sex. In that situation, some of the amphibians will spontaneously begin to change sex from female to male.
And you think that's what happened to the dinosaurs?
Until we have a better explanation, yes, Grant said. I think that's what happened. Now, shall we find this nest?
They piled into the jeep, and Lex lifted the raptor from the cage. The animal seemed quite calm, almost tame in her hands. She gave it a final pat on the head and released it. The animal wouldn't leave.
Go on, shoo, Lex said. Go home.
The raptor turned and ran off into the foliage. Grant held the receiver and wore the headphones. Muldoon drove. The car bounced along the main road going south. Gennaro turned to Grant and said,
What is it like, this nest?
Nobody knows, Grant said.
But I thought you dug them up.
I've dug up fossil dinosaur nests, Grant said, but all fossils are distorted by the weight of millennia. We've made some hypotheses, some suppositions, but nobody really knows what the nests were like. Grant listened to the beeps and signaled Muldoon to head farther west. It looked more and more as if Ellie had been correct. The nest was in the southern volcanic fields. Grant shook his head.
You have to realize, we don't know all the details about the nesting behavior of living reptiles like crocodiles and alligators. They're difficult animals to study.
But it was known that in the case of American alligators, only the female guarded the nest, awaiting the time of hatching. The bull alligator spent days in early spring lying beside the female in a mating pair, blowing bubbles on her cheeks to bring her to receptivity, finally causing her to lift her tail and allow him to insert his penis. By the time the female built her nest 2 months later, the male was long gone. The female guarded her cone-shaped 3-foot-high nest ferociously. And when the hatchlings began to squeak and emerge from their shells, she often helped break open the eggs, then nudged them toward the water, sometimes carrying them in her mouth.
So adult alligators protect the young?
Yes, Grant said. And there is also a kind of group protection. Young alligators make a distinctive distress cry, and it brings any adult who hears it, parent or not, to their assistance, with a full-fledged violent attack. Not a threat display, a full-on attack.
Oh.
Gennaro fell silent.
But dinos aren't reptiles, Muldoon said laconically.
Exactly. The dinosaur nesting pattern could be much more closely related to that of any of a variety of birds.
So you actually mean you don't know?
Gennaro said, getting annoyed.
You don't know what the nest is like?
No, Grant said, I don't.
Well, Gennaro said, so much for the damned experts.
Grant ignored him. Already he could smell the sulfur, and up ahead he saw the rising steam of the volcanic fields. The ground was hot, Gennaro thought as he walked forward. It was actually hot, and here and there mud bubbled and spat up from the ground, and the reeking sulfurous steam hissed in great shoulder-high plumes. He felt as if he were walking through hell. He looked at Grant, walking along with a headset on, listening to the beeps. Grant in his cowboy boots and his jeans and his Hawaiian shirt, apparently very cool. Gennaro didn't feel cool. He was frightened to be in this stinking, hellish place with the velociraptors somewhere around. He didn't understand how Grant could be so calm about it. Or the woman, Sattler. She was walking along, too, just looking calmly around.
Doesn't this bother you? Gennaro said. I mean, worry you?
We've got to do it, Grant said. He didn't say anything else.
They all walked forward among the bubbling steam vents. Gennaro fingered the gas grenades that he had clipped to his belt. He turned to Ellie. Why isn't he worried about it?
Maybe he is, she said, but he's also thought about this for his whole life.
Gennaro nodded and wondered what that would be like, whether there was anything he had waited his whole life for. He decided there wasn't anything. Grant squinted in the sunlight. Ahead, through veils of steam, an animal crouched, looking at them. Then it scampered away.
Was that the raptor? Ellie said.
I think so. Or another one. Juvenile, anyway.
She said, leading us on?
Maybe. Ellie had told him how the raptors had played at the fence to keep her attention while another climbed onto the roof. If true, such behavior implied a mental capacity that was beyond nearly all forms of life on Earth. Classically, the ability to invent and execute plans was believed to be limited to only three species: chimpanzees, gorillas, and human beings. Now there was the possibility that a dinosaur might be able to do such a thing, too. The raptor appeared again, darting into the light, then jumping away with a squeak. It really did seem to be leading them on. Gennaro frowned. How smart are they? He said.
If you think of them as birds, Grant said, then you have to wonder. Some new studies show the gray parrot has as much symbolic intelligence as a chimpanzee, and chimpanzees can definitely use language. Now researchers are finding that parrots have the emotional development of a 3-year-old child, but their intelligence is unquestioned. Parrots can definitely reason symbolically. But I've never heard of anybody killed by a parrot, Gennaro grumbled.
Distantly, they could hear the sound of the surf on the island shore. The volcanic fields were behind them now, and they faced a field of boulders. The little raptor climbed up onto one rock and then abruptly disappeared.
Where did it go?
Ellie said. Grant was listening to the earphones. The beeping stopped. He's gone. They hurried forward and found in the midst of the rocks a small hole, like a rabbit hole. It was perhaps 2 feet in diameter. As they watched, the juvenile raptor reappeared, blinking in the light. Then it scampered away.
No way, Gennaro said. No way I'm going down there.
Grant said nothing. He and Ellie began to plug in equipment. Soon he had a small video camera attached to a handheld monitor. He tied the camera to a rope, turned it on, and lowered it down the hole.
You can't see anything that way, Gennaro said.
Let it adjust, Grant said. There was enough light along the upper tunnel for them to see smooth dirt walls, and then the tunnel opened out suddenly, abruptly. Over the microphone they heard a squeaking sound, then a lower trumpeting sound. More noises coming from many animals.
Sounds like the nest, all right, Ellie said.
But you can't see anything, Gennaro said. He wiped the sweat off his forehead.
No, Grant said, but I can hear. He listened for a while longer, and then hauled the camera out and set it on the ground. Let's get started. He climbed up toward the hole. Ellie went to get a flashlight and a shock stick. Grant pulled the gas mask on over his face and crouched down awkwardly, extending his legs backward.
You can't be serious about going down there, Gennaro said.
Grant nodded.
It doesn't thrill me. I'll go first, then Ellie, then you come after.
Now wait a minute, Gennaro said in sudden alarm. Why don't we drop these nerve gas grenades down the hole, then go down afterward? Doesn't that make more sense? Ellie, you got the flashlight? She handed the flashlight to Grant.
What about it? Gennaro said. What do you say?
I'd like nothing better, Grant said. He backed down toward the hole.
You ever seen anything die from poison gas?
No.
It generally causes convulsions. Bad convulsions.
Well, I'm sorry if it's unpleasant, but look, Grant said. We're going into this nest to find out how many animals have hatched. If you kill the animals first, and some of them fall on the nests in their spasms, that will ruin our ability to see what was there, so we can't do that.
But you made these animals, Mr. Gennaro.
I didn't.
Your money did. Your efforts did. You helped create them. They're your creation. And you can't just kill them because you feel a little nervous now.
I'm not a little nervous, Gennaro said. I'm scared shit. Follow me, Grant said. Ellie handed him a shock stick. He pushed backward through the hole and grunted.
Tight fit.
Grant exhaled and extended his arms forward in front of him, and there was a kind of whoosh. and he was gone. The hole gaped, empty and black. "What happened to him?" Gennaro said, alarmed. Ellie stepped forward and leaned close to the hole, listening at the opening. She clicked the radio, said softly, "Alan?" There was a long silence. Then they heard, faintly, "I'm here." "Is everything all right, Alan?" Another long silence. When Grant finally spoke, his voice sounded distinctly odd, almost awestruck. "Everything's fine," he said. Almost Paradigm. In the lodge, John Hammond paced back and forth in Malcolm's room. Hammond was impatient and uncomfortable. Since marshaling the effort for his last outburst, Malcolm had slipped into a coma, and now it appeared to Hammond that he might actually die. Of course, a helicopter had been sent for, but God knows when it would arrive. The thought that Malcolm might die in the meantime filled Hammond with anxiety and dread. And paradoxically, Hammond found it all much worse because he disliked the mathematician so much. It was worse than if the man were his friend. Hammond felt that Malcolm's death, should it occur, would be the final rebuke, and that was more than Hammond could bear. In any case, the smell in the room was quite ghastly, the rotten decay of human flesh.
"Everything had,"
Malcolm said, tossing on the pillow.
"Is he waking up?" Hammond said.
Harding shook his head.
"What did he say? Something about paradise?"
"I didn't catch it," Harding said. Hammond paced some more. He pushed the window wider, trying to get some fresh air. Finally, when he couldn't stand it, he said,
"Is there any problem about going outside?"
"I don't think so, no," Harding said.
"I think this area is all right." "Well, look, I'm going outside for a bit."
"All right," Harding said. He adjusted the flow on the intravenous antibiotics.
"I'll be back soon."
"All right." Hammond left, stepping out into the daylight, wondering why he had bothered to justify himself to Harding. After all, the man was his employee. Hammond had no need to explain himself. He went through the gates of the fence, looking around the park. It was late afternoon, the time when the blowing mist was thinned and the sun sometimes came out. The sun was out now, and Hammond took it as an omen. Say what they would, he knew that his park had promise, and even if that impetuous fool Gennaro decided to burn it to the ground, it would not make much difference. Hammond knew that in two separate vaults at InGen headquarters in Palo Alto were dozens of frozen embryos. It would not be a problem to grow them again, on another island, elsewhere in the world. And if there had been problems here, then the next time they would solve those problems. That was how progress occurred, by solving problems. As he thought about it, he concluded that Wu had not really been the man for the job. Wu had obviously been sloppy, too casual with his great undertaking. And Wu had been too preoccupied with the idea of making improvements. Instead of making dinosaurs, he had wanted to improve on them. Hammond suspected darkly that was the reason for the downfall of the park. Wu was the reason. Also, we had to admit that John Arnold was ill-suited for the job of chief engineer. Arnold had impressive credentials, but at this point in his career he was tired, and he was a fretful worrier. He hadn't been organized, and he had missed things, important things. In truth, neither Wu nor Arnold had had the most important characteristic, Hammond decided, the characteristic of vision. That great sweeping act of imagination which evoked a marvelous park, where children pressed against the fences, wondering at the extraordinary creatures come alive from their storybooks. Real vision. The ability to see the future. The ability to marshal resources to make that future vision a reality. No, neither Wu nor Arnold was suited to that task. And for that matter, Ed Regis had been a poor choice, too. Harding was at best an indifferent choice. Muldoon was a drunk. Hammond shook his head. He would do better next time. Lost in his thoughts, he headed toward his bungalow, following the little path that ran north from the visitor center. He passed one of the workmen who nodded curtly. Hammond did not return the nod. He found the Tecan workman to be uniformly insolent. To tell the truth, the choice of this island off Costa Rica had also been unwise. He would not make such obvious mistakes again. When it came, the roar of the dinosaur seemed frighteningly close. Hammond spun so quickly he fell on the path, and when he looked back he thought he saw the shadow of the juvenile T-Rex moving in the foliage beside the flagstone path, moving toward him. What was a T-Rex doing here? Why was it outside the fences? Hammond felt a flash of rage, and then he saw the Tecan workman running for his life, and Hammond took the moment to get to his feet and dash blindly into the forest on the opposite side of the path. He was plunged in darkness. He stumbled and fell, his face mashed into wet leaves and damp earth, and he staggered back up to his feet, ran onward, fell again, and then ran once more. Now he was moving down a steep hillside, and he couldn't keep his balance. He tumbled helplessly, rolling and spinning over the soft ground, before finally coming to a stop at the foot of the hill. His face splashed into shallow, tepid water, which gurgled around him and ran up his nose. He was lying face down in a little stream. He had panicked. What a fool! He should have gone to his bungalow. Hammond cursed himself. As he got to his feet, he felt a sharp pain in his right ankle that brought tears to his eyes. He tested it gingerly. Oh, it might be broken. He forced himself to put his full weight on it, gritting his teeth. Yes! Almost certainly broken. In the control room, Lex said to Tim,
I wish they had taken us with them to the nest.
It's too dangerous for us, Lex, Tim said. We have to stay here.
Hey, listen to this one.
He pressed another button, and a recorded tyrannosaur roar echoed over the loudspeakers in the park.
That's neat, Lex said. That's better than the other one.
You can do it too, Tim said. And if you push this, you get reverb.
Let me try, Lex said.
She pushed the button. The tyrannosaur roared again.
Can we make it last longer, she said.
Sure, Tim said. We just twist this thing here. Lying at the bottom of the hill, Hammond heard the tyrannosaur roar bellowing through the jungle. Jesus! He shivered hearing that sound. It was terrifying, a scream from some other world. He waited to see what would happen. What would the tyrannosaur do? Had it already gotten that workman? Hammond waited, hearing only the buzz of the jungle cicadas, until he realized he was holding his breath, and let out a long sigh. With his injured ankle, he couldn't climb the hill. He would have to wait at the bottom of the ravine. After the tyrannosaur had gone, he would call for help. Meanwhile, he was in no danger here.
Then he heard an amplified voice say, Come on, Timmy! I get to try it too! Come on! Let me make the noise!
The kids! The tyrannosaur roared again, but this time it had distinct musical overtones and a kind of echo persisting afterward.
Neat one, said the little girl. Do it again.
Those damn kids. They should never have brought those kids. They had been nothing but trouble from the beginning. Nobody wanted them around. Hammond had only brought them because he thought it would stop Gennaro from destroying the resort. But Gennaro was going to do it anyway. And the kids had obviously gotten into the control room and started fooling around again. Now who had allowed that? He felt his heart begin to race, and felt an uneasy shortness of breath. He forced himself to relax. There was nothing wrong. Although he could not climb the hill, he could not be more than 100 yards from his own bungalow and the visitor center. Hammond sat down in the damp earth, listening to the sounds in the jungle around him. And then, after a while, he began to shout for help. Malcolm's voice was no louder than a whisper.
Everything looks different on the other side, he said.
Harding leaned close to him. On the other side? He thought that Malcolm was talking about dying.
When it shifts,
Malcolm said.
Shifts?
Malcolm didn't answer. His dry lips moved.
Paradigm,
he said finally. Paradigm shifts, Harding said. He knew about paradigm shifts. For the last 2 decades, they had been the fashionable way to talk about scientific change. Paradigm was just another word for a model, but as scientists used it, the term meant something more, a world view.
a larger way of seeing the world. Paradigm shifts were said to occur whenever science made a major change in its view of the world. Such changes were relatively rare, occurring about once a century. Darwinian evolution had forced a paradigm shift. Quantum mechanics had forced a smaller shift.
No,
Malcolm said.
Not paradigm. Beyond.
Beyond paradigm? Harding said.
Don't care about what anymore.
Harding sighed. Despite all efforts, Malcolm was rapidly slipping into a terminal delirium. His fever was higher, and they were almost out of his antibiotics. What don't you care about?
Anything, Malcolm said. Because everything looks different on the other side.
And he smiled. Descent. You're crazy, Gennaro said to Ellie Sattler, watching as she squeezed backward into the rabbit hole, stretching her arms forward. You're crazy to do that. She smiled. Probably, she said. She reached forward with her outstretched hands and pushed backward against the sides of the hole, and suddenly she was gone. The hole gaped black. Gennaro began to sweat. He turned to Muldoon, who was standing by the jeep. I'm not doing this, he said. Yes, you are. I can't do this. I can't. They're waiting for you, Muldoon said. You have to. Christ only knows what's down there, Gennaro said. I'm telling you, I can't do it. You have to. Gennaro turned away, looked at the hole, looked back. I can't. You can't make me. I suppose not, Muldoon said. He held up the stainless steel prod. Ever felt a shock stick? No. Doesn't do much, Muldoon said. Almost never fatal. Generally knocks you flat. Perhaps loosens your bowels. But it doesn't usually have any permanent effect, at least not on dinos. But then people are much smaller. Gennaro looked at the stick. You wouldn't. I think you better go down and count those animals, Muldoon said. And you better hurry. Gennaro looked back at the hole, at the black opening, a mouth in the earth. Then he looked at Muldoon standing there, large and impassive. Gennaro was sweating and light-headed. He started walking toward the hole. From a distance it appeared small, but as he came closer it seemed to grow larger.
That's it, Muldoon said.
Gennaro climbed backward into the hole, but he began to feel too frightened to continue that way. The idea of backing into the unknown filled him with dread. So at the last minute he turned around and climbed head first into the hole, extending his arms forward and kicking his feet, because at least he would see where he was going. He pulled the gas mask over his face. And suddenly he was rushing forward, sliding into blackness, seeing the dirt walls disappear into darkness before him, and then the walls became narrower, much narrower, terrifyingly narrow, and he was lost in the pain of a squeezing compression that became steadily worse and worse, that crushed the air out of his lungs, and he was only dimly aware that the tunnel tilted slightly upward along the path, shifting his body, leaving him gasping and seeing spots before his eyes, and the pain was extreme, and then suddenly the tunnel tilted downward again, and it became wider, and Gennaro felt rough surfaces, concrete, and cold air. His body was suddenly free and bouncing, tumbling on concrete, and then he fell. Voices in the darkness, fingers touching him, reaching forward from the whispered voices. The air was cold, like a cave. Okay?
He looks okay, yes.
He's breathing.
Fine.
A female hand caressing his face. It was Ellie. Can you hear? She whispered. Why is everybody whispering? He said. Because. She pointed. Gennaro turned, rolled, got slowly to his feet. He stared as his vision grew accustomed to the darkness. But the first thing that he saw gleaming in the darkness was eyes. Glowing green eyes. Dozens of eyes. All around him. He was on a concrete ledge, a kind of embankment about 7 feet above the floor. Large steel junction boxes provided a makeshift hiding place, protecting them from the view of the two full-sized velociraptors that stood directly before them, not 5 feet away. The animals were dark green, with brownish tiger stripes.
They stood upright, balancing on their stiff, extended tails. They were totally silent, looking around watchfully with large, dark eyes. At the feet of the adults, baby velociraptors skittered and chirped. Farther back in the darkness,